I'm Christopher Lydon with the ever-astonishing English novelist Jeanette Winterson, who really was raised by wolves, it turns out, in the form of adoptive parents, evangelical brutes, mom especially, who liked to tell her the devil had led them to the wrong crib. This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Jeanette Winterson, it is an honor to engage you. The new memoir is called Why Be Happy When You Could Be Normal? And it recapitulates in some ways the novel that made you famous 25 years ago, Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit. And I'm thinking as I read, so this is what it takes to launch an explosive, indomitable writer who is becoming a sort of modern classic around the 50-year mark. Is that fair? Is that the idea?
Well, it's a bit of a surprise. You know, I'm on so many courses and syllabi now, and the kids are reading me. And, of course, I'm just about now old enough to be their mother, which is rather touching and surprising. But, you know, I'm lucky because young readers are coming with me. It hasn't turned into a kind of generational fix. I'm getting people coming through who just love the books and are finding something different there. And that's exciting because kids are the future. And if I can speak to them, if I can open their imaginations, if I can change the way they think, then that's good enough for me.
Well, you change older readers too, if I may say, for the gray-haired set. And there's so much here that transcends almost everything we think of as categories of gender or generation or sexual preference or history or nation. The book is a marvel to me. But let's just begin where everybody does, because the opening page has this extraordinary introduction of your adoptive mother, Mrs. Winterson. You write, she was a flamboyant, depressive, a woman who kept a revolver in the duster drawer and the bullets in a tin of Pledge, a woman who stayed up all night baking cakes to avoid sleeping in the same bed as my father, a woman with a prolapse, a thyroid condition, an enlarged heart, an ulcerated leg that never healed, and two sets of false teeth, matte for every day and a pearlized set for best. I keep wondering, where do these sentences come from? There's an energy, there's a discipline, there's a leanness. Did that spill out of the back of your head, or was that a month's work?
Well, perhaps it was 25 years' work. I mean, you do get somewhere after all this time. And I like to write short sentences, and I like to make the language work hard. One of the things I wanted to do from the very beginning was to take the disciplines, the intensities, the density of poetry, and to fuse that language within the stretch of narrative, so that I didn't want to just be running the thing to turn the page. I wanted the language itself to be doing the work. And you get to something like a moment of grace, I suppose, by now, where you've taken apart language so many times, and I think of it, you know, the way boys take engines apart, you know, that's been always been my relationship to language. It's something I understood in a place of delight for me. So by now, I do have a certain facility. And also, I have the legacy of Mrs. Winterson. You know, this was a woman who spoke in aphorisms and who stuck biblical texts and texts of her own all around the house, you know, short, pithy, like advertising-style language. And that's helped me in my work. There's no question of it. You know, and that's why she has all the best lines.
Leaping to the end and the reader's impression, it's not that you become Mrs. Winterson, but you speak just now of the legacy. It's the sense of the things she gave you, starting with words. You write that she was a natural-born pamphleteer, a sloganeer, an advertising maybe, but that sedition and controversy were fired in her head by printed matter, thus your life, your career. But then there's also the Bible, of which you memorized big chunks. And third, she gave you something to rebel against, which maybe we all need. I'm thinking she would go around the house singing this doomsday song, God has blotted them out, this whole idea, as you write, of life as a pre-death experience. And you would sing back at her, in effect, cheer up, ye saints of God. Somebody says to you in the book, what would you have been without her? Interesting question.
Oh, I'd have gone into property and made a fortune. There's no question of it. I love doing up old houses. I mean, I really love it. I'm not sure now if it's a pathology or not, or if it's just inner houses and outer houses, and maybe that's another way of creating something in the world. But I did have a terrible alternative reality experience not so long ago, where I was all dressed up, and for reasons that I can't go into on the radio, I had a spray tan. And I was sitting in this bar with some sponsors for an art gallery that we'd raise money for, and I suddenly realized that I would always have been in this outfit with the spray tan in this bar, but that by now I'd have gone through two or three husbands and I'd have had a ranch style house with a hot tub. I'd have made a lot of money, but I would have lost poetry and I would have lost beauty. Because there's a marvellous bit that the poet Coleridge talks about how poetry keeps the heart awake to love and beauty. And I suppose that's what I found through language. You know, it wasn't just the raw energy, the kind of feral Jeanette breaking out of that terrible place in the coal hole and in the north. It was finding something which could stop my heart from calcifying. And that's what language and literature can do.
There's another big point here for me, that the feeling in the book is at its core somehow religious. It's not anything like the old orthodoxy that you and I, in my way, grew up in, but it's not out of harmony with the essential chords either, it seems to me. For example, you write about second chances, and that you're speaking in your own voice, but you say, life is all about second chances. Well, that is as much as anything what Jesus preached. I mean, the lost sheep, the one in 100, and the welcome to absolutely everybody in any circumstance. But there are many instances of it. You write, it's hard to speak about, but of trying suicide, and the Gospel of John comes out of nowhere. You must be born again. And there are lots of others. I love the notion in the book that the mind wants to heal itself, the body too, but we seek order. It's not a random game in the end.
It depends what you believe about the human psyche and whether or not you do believe that it tends towards health. I believe it does. And I think that creativity is on the side of health. There is a huge mistake, a romantic longing for death and suicide and craziness, which has always put creativity with the mad. But I don't believe that. I think there are lots of complicated reasons why artists go mad, and indeed why they try to kill themselves. But I don't think being creative is one of those reasons. I think that creativity in all of us is the thing that pulls you back and tries to keep you sane and tries to open the place which has got narrowed. You know, we go crazy when it's like it's almost like a sclerosis of the mind. It's when everything narrows down. When the arteries harden and the blood can't get through, you get a heart attack. The same thing happens. It can happen in your head. Everything narrows down and something explodes in you, and therefore you explode yourself. You go crazy or you try to kill yourself. And I think that one of the things that art does is prevent both this hardening and this narrowing. It can keep you open while still keeping you protected. So you can afford to let down your defences because you're defended by something which is much greater, much more real, I think. And this is what art allows. And that's why I go around saying to people, listen, if you think art's a luxury, then being human is a luxury.
I don't want to put religious words in or thoughts into your head, but I'm thinking, what is the difference between what you're speaking of, creativity, and grace in St. Paul's sense, or even the redemptive energy in the world that Dostoevsky is just so full of?
I don't think there's a difference as such. We're not dealing here in differences in kind. We're dealing in different manifestations of a healing, healthful, creative energy, as far as I'm concerned, which I think is the essence of the human spirit. I think it's who we are. You know, every child ever born on this planet in any time is born creative. All of those little kids, you know, they want to do dances, they want to play an instrument, they want to paint a picture and stick it on the fridge, they want to listen to stories, they want to tell stories. You know, children are born that way. They want to play. They're naturally creative. We then knock it out of them, and then we say art, it's elitist, it's just for the few, not for the many. It's not. But I think we can go back to that central core energy of ourselves at any time if we believe it's there, and by that find a force not dependent on God, not dependent on the divine. You don't have to be religious to recognize that there is some greater force which appears to motivate us as human beings.
I'm just fascinated by sort of unconscious echoes of Christian truth, including one of my dearest friends who said to me one time, Chris, you have to understand one thing. I said, what's that? He said, you can do no wrong in my eyes. That sense of unconditional love and the bond that we all want, we all get now and then, but this book is full of it. You're right. I'd always read mind, body, spirit stuff because if you're raised on the Bible, you don't just walk away whatever anybody says. So what is it that connects you to that still?
You don't walk away. You can forcefully drag yourself away, and then people tend to become fundamentalist in the opposite direction. They become so vehement in their denials of any spiritual possibility that you wonder what it is they're so nervous about. For me, anyway, it's easy to sense and to feel at home in a spiritual dimension in the world and in me. I mean, I have a lot of energy and a large energy, and it feels connected. You know, I don't feel solitary and isolated and stuck in some little place of my own. I feel involved in something much bigger. But I do think that's the creative force that pushes through. And so I'm happy to take my truths wherever I can find them. And there's plenty in the Bible. It's a good book. You know, I wish the religious right would actually read the Bible. You know, then we might get somewhere. You know, I mean, I don't see Jesus giving breaks to tax collectors and the big corporations. I see him hanging out with prostitutes and the poor and the dispossessed, you know, and you think, hold on, didn't you read this bit? And I love that part in the Gospels where Jesus talks about the kingdom of heaven is within you. That's a very profound comment. And if it's within us, that's where we need to be looking, because it means it's not outside of us, which means it's not just that it's not in the world of commerce and shopping and business, but it means that it cannot be supplied by organized religion, because it's in, it's not out. So this seems to me an often overlooked truth.
You could wish that Rick Santorum reminded you of Jesus a little tiny bit. Say something, do something, wear something. There's a great moment toward the end when you've met your birth mother. She's a working woman. She's been married 4 times, lives outside Manchester in England. And you go to lunch and you reflect for yourself that I would rather be this me, the me that I had become, and might probably not have had you grown up with your biological mom. Is there any reconciliation there with Mrs. Winterson?
Oh, Mrs. Winterson and I certainly reconciled long after her death, but you can't be reconciled with anyone, alive or dead, unless you're able to forgive them. That's the crucial thing. And you can't forgive anybody, alive or dead, unless you are able to understand them. And that allows for a different kind of compassion. And perhaps that takes time. You know, my mother died just around when I was 30, Mrs. Winston, and so there wasn't time, because the only one who could have put it right was me. She never could do that, and it was too early for me. So it's taken me another 20 years to reconcile myself to that place. But I have done so, and it feels a lot better, and I'm very happy to have done it. And as for, you know, with my biological mother, with Biomar, as I call her, I wouldn't have had the education, and I wouldn't have had the books, and I wouldn't have had all the things I've had to push against. That's why I'm glad that I have my own crazy upbringing, however difficult, however painful. But I think, you know, a lot of people who are adopted, they imagine that there'll be some important reunion and that they'll feel something that they can't feel, because they imagine it's in their DNA. DNA is so fashionable now. You know, we think that everything is about biology. I really don't think it is. I think the way that you were brought up is very important and will affect the whole of your life. You're not going to meet somebody, even if it's your birth mother, 50 years later, and feel an enormous connection. And a lot of adopted people have written to me about this book and said, you know, you helped me to forgive myself for not feeling the things I thought I should feel.
Where do I get a chance to just admire some of your sentences, Jeanette Winterson? They're extraordinary. Out of nowhere, for example, you're writing about Manchester, the engine of England's wealth in the 19th century. You write, Manchester spun riches beyond anybody's wildest dreams and wove despair and degradation into the human fabric. That's one. And at a completely different level, a sentence I love, you write later on, the things that I regret in my life are not errors of judgment, but failures of feeling. Wonderful ideas, wonderful words.
I think failure of feeling sums it up for me. We are so used to trying to suppress our feelings, or the, you know, the classic thing that couples do, where one does all the weeping and the shouting, and the other is supposed to be steely-eyed and rational. It's just a kind of trade-off on the sort of feeling exchange. And it seems to me that extremes, whether you're wanton or you're tame, whether you're raging or you're tranquilized, those extremes have the same effect. They insulate you from feeling, because feeling is so difficult. It's so painful to actually be in the feeling. It's one of the hardest things that we can do. And again, that's, you know, that takes me back to books and to art, because it is a place of feeling, you know, where we can risk opening up, where we can cry, we can laugh. we can know ourselves fully, not just as somebody from the neck up with a kind of brain. You know, it's much more than that. You know, it's not about simply using your mind. It's about using your whole body. And that's how I write, and that's how I try and live.
You know, I've been rereading you, most especially The Passion and Written on the Body. It's an extraordinary body of work. Harold Bloom, who's our kind of gold standard, had you in the canon, the Western canon, for The Passion. We talk continuously with Harold Bloom about the living labyrinth of literature, as I wish you'd called his last book. How does it feel to be inside this beast of influences coming at you and what you're handing on with a new spin?
It feels perfectly right. And Harold Bloom wouldn't mind me quoting T.S. Eliot, where he says that for us, there's only the trying and the rest is not our business. I think that's very important. You know, you can never evaluate yourself in terms of the world or in terms of success or in terms of posterity. Who knows if there'll even be a posterity. And I never think about that. I think about the work that I'm doing at the time that I'm doing it. And it does surprise me that 27 years have passed now, and there is this body of work. And part of me looks at it and think, where did that come from? You know, I'm as surprised as anybody else, because it's the best of you, but it's also the thing that's created almost in a sealed chamber, not separate from your life, but in this place of absolute intensity. I think of myself as heating myself up to story temperature. And once I do get to story temperature, I can throw anything on that fire. I can throw on old mattresses, tires, tin cans, and it'll all burn up and produce something else, something different, and a different quantity. But you don't live at that rev all of the time. It is qualitatively different. And so I simply just immerse myself in that work and then leave the rest to everybody else. And, you know, I've had my fair share of the tomatoes.
But in the Bloomian sense, I want to ask you not about your favorite writers, but the ones that he would say you're the child of. Could be anybody.
Well, I learned to read in the Accrington Public Library, which was an old-fashioned library, in fact built with Carnegie money in 1907, and it took itself very seriously. Those were the days when, you know, reading wasn't elitist, and if you were working class, it was seen as something you might want to do to improve your mind. You know, all culture wasn't relative and of equal value. You know, whether it was Elvis or Shakespeare, it was assumed that you might want to read Shakespeare. So I set off down to the Accrington Public Library, and I read my way through English literature in prose A to Z, and it was all there. So I just thought, okay, I'll start. And of course, the last name's Austin, so you get off to quite a good start. Then you do Bronte's, Dickens, Eliot. So the beginning is rather optimistic. I got a bit soggy in the middle when I hit Nabokov. I was rather disappointed there to pull myself together about that, and I think that was the beginning of my feminism. But then I realised that the great writers weren't remote. They were in Accrington, in this small no-hope town in the middle of nowhere, and that meant that I could be part of that. So it didn't feel like something which was miles outside of me. It felt like something which was there for me. And that's the crucial difference, because then you feel you can do it yourself. And I thought, well, maybe I could get a book on the shelves of English literature A to Z.
Did you ever experience what Harold Bloom calls famously the anxiety of influence? Like, George Eliot is my mom and I've got to pick up the thread from her?
Well, you know, I'm a big fan of Harold Bloom, but not everything that he says is right. And I think it's a real boy thing, this anxiety of influence, because it all goes back into the Oedipus complex and they're all rushing around trying to kill their father. But in any case, that's only part of the story, you know, because you have to remember that Oedipus, of course, is adopted. That's a much more interesting part of the story to me, rather than the bit that tends to be taken up after Freud, which is about murdering your father. Of course, it happens at a crossroads. I often think that if they'd had roundabouts in those days, this tragedy would never have taken place, because they would have known how to give way. But there we are. Nobody ever says, do they, you know, I've reached a real roundabout in my life. We've always reaching a crossroads. But no, I don't feel that. Rather, I felt shored up and supported. Now, it may be that as a woman, you have so few private ancestors. It's getting a lot better now, but you know, it's still new for us. Women haven't even had the vote for 100 years. You know, we're finding our power, our creativity. We can't go back and say, a long way, and say, there's another woman doing what I want to do. So there is a difference. So far from wanting to kill anybody off, Jesus, you want to keep them as close to you as you can, because you need them all.
And what about influence in the other way? In what sense do your big books, starting with Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit, change the landscape for young women writing today, young men for that matter?
Yes, that is happening. I mean, a lot of people now say, oh, you know, it was Jeanette Winterson, or I read this book, or, the, you know, maybe it's The Passion, maybe it's The Power book. You never know what you'll come across. But it is in there, and, you know, that's happening, that's changing the way people think. I like that, and it seems to me to be part of the continuum, but it doesn't give me a messiah complex. It just makes me think, great, I did find a place, I did get a book on the shelves of English Literature A to Z.
What do you think the it is that people will say maybe 50 years from now, ah, that was a, she learned that from Jeanette Winterson. She learned that from Written on the Body, for example.
I have no idea, because it's not my business to know. If I started to think like that, I would become both self-conscious and unnecessarily academic. I can't go around worrying about my influence or my posterity. All I can do is write with my own voice, which is very clear. And what I hope is that when people open the book, they know that this is a Jeanette Winterson page, or it's quite easy to spot me. Because in the end, all we're looking for is a voice, something which is obviously of the writer, a style, a way of thinking, a way of being. What I hope I do is really have that, allow that intensity of feeling, that emotional experience to be in the books, as well as a lot of ideas, a lot of concepts. You know, I don't want to write just a novel of ideas. I've always thought they were the most sterile of things, and that what was necessary was to push through feeling and emotion, because if art's not an emotional experience, I'm not quite sure what it's for.
Written on the Body, for me, is a kind of, was for me a sort of breakthrough in writing about love energy, especially because of the famous device in which the narrator, who's overwhelmed by love for a beautiful woman, is never identified as male or female. There are lots of clues, and one makes assumptions going along, but it's never precisely clear, and you've changed, for me, the way of thinking about erotic energy and love passion. And that's an idea, perhaps more than a kind of a stylistic breakthrough. But, you know, books are different after that. To read them or to write them, I would think. Do you know what I mean?
I hope so. I wanted to see how much of the scaffolding of a novel you could pull away and still leave something which would be absorbing and coherent. So we don't know anything really about the narrator in Written on the Body. Very little. He appears to have no background, no visible means of support, and of course, yeah, no gender. But that was because I wanted to see what it would feel like, how uncomfortable it might make the reader if they couldn't put a pronoun to the feeling, and it does make people uncomfortable, and actually they get quite cross about it. And that in itself tells us something about what we need to assume when we're talking. We need to know the gender of the character. You know, it's like when you see a mother with a baby, you always want to know at once, is it a boy or a girl? Because usually you can't tell at that stage. Why do we want to know? I've always found that rather curious, because it seems to me that gender should be a toolkit, not a final destination, and that your biology is just the beginning of your life adventure, and shouldn't in any way shape it so that there is no opportunity for discovery or adventure.
Sort of a different version of the question for me is, I wonder how your sense of your audience has changed since Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit. I expect your audience has come a long way with you in thinking about these things, that it's not gender or sexual orientation audience as it might have been 25 years ago. But I wonder if you write differently, or you think of your audience differently.
Well, without being rude to my audience, I never think of them at all. Largely because I can't, because there are, who knows, and because also it's always changing. And so what I try and do is think about the experience that I might be offering through the medium of the book, because we meet on the steps of a story. It's, you know, that's where I feel that I gather together with my audience. That's what's between us. And it, you know, a book is intimate. It is like lover's talk. It's a one-to-one experience, and it happens inside your head. And the only other space that happens really is when you're in bed with somebody. You have that close intimacy that nobody else can intrude there. And one of the reasons why reading, I think, is so subversive, it's not the content of the book necessarily, it's the privacy of the act. So that at a time when everywhere is CCTV and surveillance, the kind of mass mind, here is something which is the polar opposite of the mass mind. Here is something which cannot be read outside of the space and is entirely private. Nobody can know what you're thinking. And that's profoundly unsettling to demagogues and dictators everywhere. And even to a consumer society like ours, you know, where all they want to know is our shopping habits, what we're thinking, what we're reading. You know, it's all about trying to find some profile of the consumer. When you're reading a book, there's no profile of the consumer. There's the intimacy and the dialogue between you and the text. And that in itself is radical and it's separate. And that's why reading can never be a passive act, you know, because it's a challenge by its very nature to the world that we have at present.
How did you discover that? I love hearing you talk about it. And your readers sort of sense it, and we grow as we turn the page. But, I mean, how did these things come to your head, your life?
Well, only in the same way that, you know, a painter looks at an apple. You know, when we look at a Cezanne apple, it's as though we see the fruit for the first time. It's such a shock. And all I do is look at what is actually happening and ask myself. So when I'm reading, I say, what is going on here? Describe it to yourself, Jeanette. So I'm in dialogue with the process. But, you know, because most of our life passes in a kind of blur or in a shorthand, we don't really notice or concentrate on what we're doing, whether it's a big task or a small task. We just want to get it done, pleasure or work. But once you start looking at it, the thing itself both becomes very odd. There's a kind of eccentricity to it, which is what we see very often in painting, because the painter can pick that up. But when we start to think about it and write about it, then we find that the thing, it's alive, it's numinous, and that's different from just passing through it as a sort of blur. So my job is to be fully concentrated and then to offer what happens to me in that concentration to the reader.
I've read you talking about writing a children's book that way, sort of cut the character in half and then have it talk to itself.
Yeah.
Walk it around the garden and find out what it's saying. Does it work that way with, should we say, your grown-up fiction?
Yes, it does. I do enjoy writing. I'm not an unhappy writer. You know, it isn't torture for me to be in my studio working. It's great pleasure. But I talk to myself out loud constantly when I'm making the thing. And I play with ideas. I think one of the things that's gone missing out of our creative endeavours is play, partly because of the endless creative writing school fiasco. And I could really murder them all. I'd like to sort of bomb the whole lot of them. Mainly because they reduce something which should be about play to a formula, as though you can suddenly work this out and then do it. And all I see are these anxious, furrowed faces of these unfortunate students who've completely forgotten that they're meant to enjoy this, and you have to be able to play with it, which also means saying, does this work? No, throw it on the fire. It's like chucking things at the wall. Does this smash? Throw it away, forget it, start again. But to do that, you have to believe in the exuberance of your creativity, and that you won't run out of ideas, and that it won't dry up. And, you know, there's an element of faith there. And if you think, if you're living in a place of poverty and lack, and you think, oh God, I've got one idea, forget it. Go and do something else.
Did I say welcome to the United States? I forgot that part. But you've been here, what, a week now?
Yeah.
And there are questions I'm dying to ask you about the US and the UK. I mean, David Cameron was here in Washington last week. You're here this week, Jeanette Winterson, royalty of another sort, or not that he's royalty. But I'm dying to ask you a question that's on my mind a lot, not with respect to your books, but it has to do with this so-called special relationship and the way it's turned sort of culturally. The trend began with Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan reinforcing each other, liking each other, and then we had that sort of John Major, George H.W. Bush interlude, and then it really got thick with George W. and Tony Blair. I think of Tony Blair as the one person on the planet who could have stopped the Iraq War. If he'd said, Mr. President, we've been there, it cost us terribly in reputation, in morality, in everything, and we got nothing. We're much happier in our post-imperial presence, but he didn't, of course, and he didn't stop the war. And meantime, what is under my skin all the time is that we have this cultural establishment from England now alive and well in the States, including Andrew Sullivan, including the late Christopher Hitchens, including Tina Brown, including Richard Dawkins is another piece of the apparatus. But the short form is that every one of these people is, it seems to me, is an imperialist, you know, just below the surface. And they have handed us, like Neil Ferguson, maybe the worst, who handed us literally in his book on empire the mission, like, it's your turn, go get him. We've been kicking these brown butts for centuries, and now you go do it. And it's become the British voice in our culture, and I don't like it. That's a complaint. That's not a question. But I wonder how it feels from your side. I also wonder what are the post-colonial, the truly post-imperial voices in England that we're not hearing.
Unfortunately, I think what you're hearing is a broad consensus from England. Tony Blair is responsible single-handedly for the Iraq War. There's no question of it. And you know, having him as an ambassador for peace in the Middle East, you know, is like putting a mosquito in charge of malaria. He is really a terrible man. And I think that's pretty much felt in the UK, yes. But, you know, we can't give up our imperialist ambitions. We know it's ridiculous, it's absurd, but they're there. And I just hope that this warmongering won't continue. I mean, I think it might. I'm sure that we're going to cause much more trouble in Afghanistan. I'm sure that there's going to be enormous amounts of trouble with Iran next. And God knows what the world would look like if we go head-to-head with Iran. There probably won't be a world for any of us to look at.
It's this whole idea of domination, world domination, which God knows the Brits practiced with a certain style for a while. But in a world of rising China, India, which owns British steel, for crying out loud, it makes Jaguars, it's consumed the old empire. There's an unreality about this picture that Cameron can reinforce with President Obama.
I don't know what the two of them are doing. I mean, let's hope Obama gets elected. If he doesn't, then we're all in big trouble. But Britain is a bit of a lost cause at the moment because we have no money. It's all been spent. All we're doing is cutting the economy, putting in austerity measures. You know, it would suit us right now to have a war because wars allow people to be distracted from what's happening in their own country. You know, I really think that the Iraq war was a lot about that for both Britain and America. You can spend whatever you like and nobody will notice too much what's going on at home because you've got this big cause. You know, and in all this global breakdown now, the economic breakdown, nobody seems to be saying how much that war cost and how much these wars go on costing and what that has contributed to the economy. You know, suddenly we can't afford welfare, but we can afford endless amounts of war. And that seems to me to be completely wrong, but nobody will talk about it. I don't know what happened to Christopher Hitchens at the end of his life. You know, he started out as a radical and he ended up as a despot.
Yeah, it's worrisome because it's implanted in this country. We were told that, you know, Tony Blair was the most popular British Prime Minister since Churchill. He spoke to the, you know, combined houses of Congress. And it was
Blair was very popular when he began. I mean, most prime ministers are popular in their first term. Margaret Thatcher was. In the second term, of course, things changed and she began going off into Argentina and sinking the Belgrano and all sorts of things. Tony Blair, this is the messiah complex that people seem to get. I mean, George Bush certainly had it. Tony Blair had it. They believe that somehow it's up to them and that God's telling them what to do. It's deeply delusional and very frightening. You know, and you wish that Richard Dawkins would address himself to that kind of megalomania instead of worrying about people who want to go to church at the weekend.
It's okay. Who are the intellectuals that we're missing? I mean, there is The Guardian, after all, thank God. There's Robert Fisk in the Middle East. There's Stephen Fry, you know, if you want to laugh at things. But what are we missing? And how did these British intellectuals get to have this kind of transatlantic standing?
The right is in the ascendancy at the moment. There is no question. And the left is struggling because it's ideologically weak. And we do need to have a left-wing revival, I think, or a socialist revival, where we win back the arguments by superior thinking and by genuine compassion. You know, in the UK, the Labour Party, the Socialist Party, after the Second World War, got into power because they had the better arguments, because Keynesian economics was a good idea. You know, and then you got Margaret Thatcher and Reagan falling in love with Milton Friedman and the Chicago School and Hayek. And, you know, since then, nothing has really changed. Society has altered so dramatically. There's no money for the poor and the dispossessed anymore, but there's money for war.
Totally different question, if I may. Cutting over a couple of decades, are you reconciled to the digital world? And I want to begin with just a phrase or two from Written on the Body, written 20 years ago, published 20 years ago. And there's this passage where the narrator is thinking, anticipating the virtual world we all live in. If you like, says the narrator, you may live in a computer-created world all day and all night. You will be able to try out a virtual life with a virtual lover. You can go into your virtual house and do virtual housework, add a baby or two, even find out if you'd rather be gay or single or straight. Why hesitate when you could simulate? The narrator goes on to say, for myself, unreconstructed as I am, I'd rather hold you in my arms and walk through the damp of a real English meadow in real English rain. I'd rather travel across the world to have you with me than lie at home dialing your telepresence. We're all in the telepresence now. But and I ask because you seem to be, you're a blogger, you love the speed of the web. Something's changed in your thinking. Can you make us love it?
I can't make you love it, but I can make you use it for good, which is the best that we can hope for. Of course, I'd always rather have the real thing. Who wouldn't? And I don't Skype my girlfriend when I'm on tour, which I suppose is the telepresence that I was thinking about 20 years ago, because I hate it. It makes me feel lonely. It doesn't make me feel connected. You know, I'd rather know that I'll see her in 2 weeks, you know, because I can live imaginatively in my head. You know, I'm not so insecure that I need to have the celluloid face on the screen every 5 minutes. However, there are advantages. The web is exciting, and it does allow for possibilities. I hate Facebook because it makes me feel like I'm in a Soviet apartment block. But I like Twitter because I enjoy the formal constraints of the 140 characters to try and tweet something interesting instead of something banal. But the thing is, this is our time. We're living in it. And you can work to change it, but you also have to do your best within it. And I've got no time for the kind of cynicism and the hand-wringing that a lot of people go in for, and some writers go in for. I mean, Jonathan Franzen does. This is our time. And, you know, there's kids growing up who are digital natives who will know everything about this media. There is no point telling them it's rubbish and they shouldn't be there. You know, what we have to do is work with it.
Three last things on my mind. There's a character in the new book that I just have to mention, Rhea Hayworth. Mm-hmm. She's a social worker who helps you find your bio-ma, and she's the soul of what the world desperately needs, a kind person. And I just wanted to say thank you for Rhea Hayworth, but maybe there's more to say.
Sometimes you do meet a really kind person, especially when you need that when you're going through the bureaucracy and the kind of legalese mania that so much of these searches, these very personal, painful searches involve. You know, it's terrible to have to go through all the legal jargon and the form filling and the meetings and the courts and the records. You know, that it's just, you're just a piece of archive to them and a rather annoying one, but to you, it's everything. And I was very lucky to have someone who could help me through it. And all I'd say, if there's anybody out there thinking of searching for any of any adoptees or their biological family, is try and get somebody on side who can steer you through the system and will show you compassion, because it is the most crazy-making process.
Mm. Well, she told you at one point she'd never seen a mother giving up a child, didn't want to keep it. And she sort of, in effect, embraced you and said, you were wanted, Jeanette. And she says it with great eloquence and conviction and power. She's one of the real stars of this book, I think.
I'm glad. She should be. I didn't realize, I mean, it seems obvious, doesn't it, that no mother ever wants to give up a baby. I mean, that's terrible, because so many women do have to give up their babies for all sorts of reasons, you know, and here we are in the 21st century and we haven't managed to arrange family life or society in such a way as children can be brought up well and happily by their parents, you know, and you get these crazy right-wing senators here still saying, you know, should we have contraception on healthcare? Should employees get contraception through their employers. I cannot believe we're having this debate, you know, now, century 21. But here I am, and fortunately, you know, my mother didn't have an abortion, fortunately. She did give me away for adoption. That was better than the alternatives. And I'd say to anybody out there, give the kid a chance.
Second last question. Have we done right by Harold Bloom? He's a great fan, I take it. And we're great fans of his. Have we done justice to Harold Bloom?
Well, I think we've done justice. I mean, Harold Bloom did call Doris Lessing a fourth-rate science fiction writer when she won the Nobel Prize, which was rather churlish of Harold. That's what I mean about how he doesn't always get it right. So, you know, we'll praise him, but we'll also say, Harold, you may need to get out more.
He also called Jimmy Carter the worst poet on the planet, which may have been right. Who knows?
I love Harold Bloom. But, you know, old men do have a vested interest in the status quo, and that's why we're always going to need young people to come along and say, hey, we can change the world, and in fact, our world doesn't look like your world. Get used to it.
Come back at the end, last question to Mrs. Winterson. Oftentimes, she gets off these incredible lines, and she is a brute, but I wondered sometimes, was there a kind of dark, sneaky humor in this redoubtable woman when she said these awful things to you? Was there even perhaps a glimmer in her mind that you could take it, you could work with it?
No, I don't. Mrs. Winston had no sense of humor at all. I mean, I know that she used to run down the lobby and shove the poker through the letterbox if anybody knocked at the door, unless it was the Mormons, because she liked haranguing them about eternal damnation, which was hard for them because they thought they were in charge of eternal damnation. But so, no, well, she didn't have a sense of humour. She just had great style and a great sense of language as punchy aphorism. You know, one of my favourites of hers is that the Bible tells us to turn the other cheek, but there's only so many cheeks in a day.
Jeanette Winterson, this book is a dreamy fulfilment of anything a reader could want. Why be happy when you could be normal? And I don't normally sound as gushy and as much like a fan as this, but I love this book. It's a huge pleasure to be in conversation with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.